From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Welfare repeal. The Senate has voted to end the guarantee of cash payments to the poor. We'll speak with Francis Fox Piven and Senator Paul Simon. Also Simon on the largest media mergers in history. And a look back at Charles Coughlin, right-wing populist and radio priest.
Oh, when will you labor leaders instruct you in these things and inform you that the only ones who profit from war are the bondholders and their servants who invest in your death? Why should I address myself, my friend, with such stinging words? I'm no opponent of labor. I'm an opponent of the blind who persist in leading the blind into the pit.
The father of hate radio, coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate has approved a welfare bill that would end the longstanding federal guarantee of cash assistance for the nation's poorest children and give states vast new power to run their own welfare and work programs with lump sums of federal money. The measure calls for the most sweeping welfare changes since the New Deal and is similar to the House bill passed last week. The Senate approved only two of the four amendments most ardently sought by President Clinton. In a surprise, the Senate narrowly rejected one of the amendments that was sought by Clinton. It was a proposal that would have allowed states to provide vouchers or other forms of non-cash assistance to families denied cash benefits because of the time limits. The vouchers could have been used to obtain diapers, cribs, clothing, medicine, or school supplies for children. And Republican defections yesterday helped score a major financial victory for the Legal Services Corporation, the agency providing legal aid to the poor that many conservatives have been trying to eliminate. 56 Republicans joined Democrats to back an amendment in the next fiscal year spending bill, adding $109 million to the corporation. But restrictions passed last year still stand that legal services lawyers cannot provide meaningful representation to their clients, which include they cannot bring class action suits or any kind of welfare reform litigation. Lawyers also can no longer lobby or contact government officials to advocate around policy. Lawyers for more than 60 protest groups planning demonstrations at next month's Republican National Convention in San Diego say they'll appeal in federal court if the GOP continues to delay approval of a designated protest zone near the convention center. A federal judge ruled on Friday that the Republicans' choice of a vacant lot three city blocks from the convention center was not adequate for satisfying the protest group's First Amendment rights of free speech and assembly because it was too remote and partially obscured from view of the center by trees and a building. And House Republicans began returning fire against Democratic and labor union television ads, unveiling the first in a $10 million sum-along series of commercials intended to tout the GOP House's accomplishments. GOP legislation intended to address people's problems will also be a focus of the next month's Republican National Convention, where citizens are to appear in person and on videotape talking about how the GOP's agenda will affect their lives. You're listening to Democracy Now! Joining us now on the telephone to talk about some recent developments is Illinois Senator Paul Simon. The epidemic of media mergers is spreading. Last week, Time Warner and Turner announced a $6.3 billion merger, the largest and latest media merger to date. Some are worried the rash of mergers is concentrating too much power in fewer and fewer hands, a move that's seen as profoundly anti-democratic. We're going to talk with Senator Simon about these developments, but before we go to that, we just wanted to ask you, Senator Simon, first about the welfare vote yesterday, the end to welfare as we know it. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, you voted against this welfare bill.
I did. I think it is a mistake. I think any welfare bill doesn't realistically do something about jobs for people of limited skills and do something about daycare is more public relations than it is welfare reform.
You know, I was just looking at comments of your sister senator in Illinois, Carol Moseley Braun, and her comments that people will rue the day that this legislation was passed. And just in the headlines, I was talking about one of the amendments which surprised many that it didn't pass. And this was the amendment that was sought by President Clinton that would allow states to provide vouchers or other forms of non-cash assistance to families denied cash benefits like diapers, cribs, medicine, or school supplies for children.
All these very basic things. When you look at the money that is going to be cut, and you look at where poor people are already in our country, we incidentally have 24% of our children living in poverty, far higher than any other Western European country, and or Japan or Australia or New Zealand. And you look at this bill, and it's going to be tougher and tougher on those children.
And yet there was a real split in the Democratic Party. I mean, you had people like liberal Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin voting for this welfare repeal.
Yes. All of us want to be for welfare reform, and I'm for welfare reform. People are on welfare for it more than anyone else. But everything that bears that tag is not welfare reform.
So what is going to happen now? The Senate has passed it. The House passed a similar version last week. It now goes to conference committee. What do you expect the final version to look like?
I expect it to be somewhat worse than the bill that passed the Senate. The bill that passed the Senate is bad. And I hope the president has the courage to veto it. It's very difficult to veto something that's labeled welfare reform in an election year, but that's precisely what the president should do.
Well, we'll see what happens. He said he wasn't happy with aspects of it, but there wasn't a condemnation from him yesterday in California when he heard the news.
Well, I know the instinct of those who are his political advisors in the White House is sign it. There are others in the White House staff who are looking at what's going to happen to these children and others and adults as well on welfare who are not looking at the election, and they're urging him to veto it.
As an elected politician yourself, what do you see as the most effective means of people letting their views be known? I mean, this is a critical point right now after the Senate and the House have passed this bill in terms of putting pressure on the president.
I think just letters to the White House right now are as effective as anything that an individual citizen can do. And this is a time for people to speak up for less fortunate people in America.
Well, we're going to talk more about what has happened around welfare, the bill to overhaul it that cleared the Senate 74-24 yesterday. We'll be speaking with Professor Francis Fox Piven. We'll also be joined by Larry Bensky in our last segment talking about this and what it means for people in this country. But right now, Senator Simon, we wanted to turn to another issue, and that is an issue that you have spoken out about in the last few months, the issue of the telecommunications bill and these latest mergers. Last week's announcement of a $6.3 billion merger between Time Warner and Turner. It's the world's largest and latest in the rash of media mega mergers. What is happening here in the wake of telecommunications, as they call it, reform?
Well, the telecommunications reform bill has opened the door to more and more concentration of ownership of the media. And in my opinion, that is not a good thing. We talk about the melting pot strength of America and as though it's some kind of a breeding process of Germans marrying Italians, marrying French, and so forth. It's that everyone brought his or her ideas into this country. And in this multiplicity of ideas, this ferment of ideas, we were able to pick the best. What media concentration is going to do is to diminish the ferment of ideas.
Tell me about how the telecommunications bill was written. You're there. You're in the Senate. Is it, as we have heard described, lobbyists coming in? You've got people like Rupert Murdoch and his advocates there actually writing the bill?
Well, I'm not on the committee that did the writing. But there is no question that we had overwhelming pressure. And an amendment I had, for example, that would have permitted an increase in the number of radio station owners, but not just taking the cap off completely on the concentration. My amendment got 38 votes, and the 38 people who obviously stood up to radio station owners and others in the media deserve great credit. But it is difficult in this kind of a situation because you like to please the media when you're in this business of politics. But we're going to end up with fewer and fewer people owning and controlling the media in this country. It is true in newspapers where we have little jurisdiction at all, but it is also true in television and radio where we do have a great deal of jurisdiction. And some of the owners of the stations that are carrying your program right now are probably unhappy with my remarks.
Tell me something, talking about pleasing the media. Last week, a group of grassroots organizations, including the Media Access Project and People for the American Way, held a news conference criticizing Senate leaders, and I'm not sure if you were one of those who signed this letter to the FCC, calling for the broadcast spectrum giveaway. This is the spectrum that would be used for digital high-definition television that is worth something like $40 billion, that Senate leaders are calling for it to be given away to the commercial broadcasters. Now, $40 billion, these groups pointed out, could buy the building of 5,800 schools, keep the water clean in this country for 18 years, and they're calling for it to be auctioned so that the government gets this money. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I favor an auction at least for the upper levels. I have to say the smaller TV stations in serving smaller markets, there you may have a problem. And I'm not enough of an expert in this area to tell you what the right answer is. But I do think there should be some protection for the smaller operators.
Mm-hmm. I just think about this on this day when they have, in essence, repealed welfare, because this is can't be described as anything but corporate welfare, because they're going to profit off of this spectrum that they're given. They can use it for cellular phone operations. They can use it for all different kinds of operations. They're being given something from the government that they will make hundreds of millions of dollars off of.
It's very interesting. People who are opposed to welfare for poor people come in. Yeah, I had a group of farmers, I'll never forget when I was in the House, who came in and denounced welfare for poor people, and then in 2 minutes later were asking me for farm subsidies. What people in the broadcast field get in terms of subsidies or grants from government, that's not labeled welfare. Or what farmers get in the way of subsidies, that's not labeled welfare. All the other things that people who are more fortunate get, those of us who own homes, we can deduct the interest in our home mortgage. I happen to favor that. I think it's a good thing, but it is a form of welfare. It's a handout to those of us who own our own homes. I think we ought to be protecting poor people as well as middle-income people and upper-income people.
Where do you stand on the whole issue of, right now, talking about television ads? You know, labor unions, the AFL-CIO, has launched this $40 million campaign through to the elections that focuses on issues and, in the end, of course, targets Republican candidates in various issues. Now, House Republicans are launching an advertising counterattack, and they're pouring $10 million into a summer-long series of commercials. Where do you stand on this?
Well, it really illustrates the need to overhaul all of our campaign financing. And if we had a system of public financing where each of us, when we fill out our income tax form, would contribute $3 or $5, for example, to the Senate races, and then limit and then say that's all you can spend is the money that you get from that, instead of spending $8.4 million as I did in my last race, and I might add I'm not running again. But instead of spending $8.4 million, maybe you'd get $2 million and then have some free radio and TV time available. I think we could diminish dramatically the negatives, and then you can, under that kind of a system, limit these kind of independent expenditures.
And yet the leader of your party, President Clinton, is not exactly forcefully pushing campaign finance reform.
No president ever pushes campaign finance reform because you have to step on the toes of members of the House and the Senate. The reality is those of us who are in office tend to think whatever system got us elected is a pretty good system.
The reality is
the system right now just really distorts democracy.
Senator Simon, why did you decide not to run again?
A combination of factors. One of them, frankly, while I enjoy policymaking and enjoy campaigning, most of my colleagues don't enjoy campaigning. I do not enjoy campaign fundraising. That's one factor, but not the major factor. I would say the two major factors are, number one, I see some of my colleagues staying on too long. I can see it in them. I'm not sure I would see it in myself. And second, on some of the peripheral things, when I first came to Washington, when there was a Democratic fundraising dinner and all the, you know, the president and everybody was there, I was so eager to go. Now I find myself dragging myself to those events. And it's an indication that my enthusiasm is waning, and it's a good time to change. And so I'm going to teach at Southern Illinois University near my home and head a public policy institute there.
Maybe it's a good sign that you don't like to go to those kind of events.
Maybe
in Washington.
Is, yes.
Maybe this is the time you should stay. Why don't all of you who are saying you're stepping down, many senators and congressmembers saying they just can't take the kind of politics that's going on today, join together in some kind of major effort around campaign finance reform since the system has been so perverted by money?
Well, I would favor that. The answer is those of us who are retiring are probably divided in our opinion on whether or not we should do this. This is one of these areas where I think you either have to have a strong president who's willing to step on some toes in Congress to get it passed, or some kind of a major scandal. One of the two things has to happen before we get real campaign finance reform.
Well, we may be headed in that direction by the elections in November. Senator Simon, since we have a few minutes, I wanted to ask you a couple questions, one about the book you wrote with Ross Perot and the other about the new gambling commission that has been set up. Where do you stand on gambling? It's an issue we took on Democracy Now! We had the Center for Public Integrity on talking about the increased amounts of money that are being given both the Democratic and Republican candidates from the gaming industry, from gamblers.
Yes, and interesting that you use the word gaming. That's what they prefer. They don't like to say we gamble, or it's not the gambling association. It has a little bit of a negative, and so they're trying to come along with a new word saying gaming instead of gambling. But
I take it back then.
No, all right. No, but the reality, it's the fastest growing legal industry in our country. It involves addiction. It is the only addiction that is promoted by government. You know, tobacco, alcohol, hard drugs. If we saw billboards out on the highway saying, drink more whiskey, it's fun, we would be offended, and yet there will be billboards for the Illinois Lottery or for casinos sponsored by state and local governments. It is a growing problem. And the commission that has just been authorized and the president has indicated he will sign, it's just to take an assessment of where we are and should the growth in this gambling be slowed.
It looks like the gamblers do have very well-connected advocates like Frank Fahrenkopf, former head of the Republican National Committee, Kenneth Duberstein, former Reagan aide.
No question about it. They have a lot of money. And one of the problems is not only the public contributions that you see, $1.2 million the last election in Illinois alone, for example, but the problems of corruption that go with easy money. You now have in four states, state legislators either under indictment or convicted for corruption in connection with legalized gambling.
We just have 30 seconds, Senator, but I did want to ask about this book you have co-written with Ross Perot, so I assume you know him quite well.
Well, I can't say I know him that well. I made a speech on the decline in the dollar. He called me and said it was he appreciated it, and one thing led to another, and even though I'm supporting Bill Clinton for re-election, we ended up writing a small paperback in language that people can understand why it is so important that we face our fiscal problems.
What do you think is the single most important way to deal with the dollar crisis?
I think we have to face up to the deficit. I think we need a constitutional amendment that says, except for emergencies, you have to balance the budget. Without that constitutional amendment, we're headed toward real problems.
But isn't it a way that the Republicans have so often used to go after issues like welfare and focus on social welfare rather than the things that really take up money in a budget like the Pentagon?
Well, they have been doing that without a constitutional amendment. In the meantime, interest chews up more and more of our money. I read where John Kennedy was complaining that in 1963, $9 billion was going to interest. This year, we're going to spend $344 billion on interest, 11 times more on interest than education, 22 times more on interest than on foreign aid, twice as much on interest as our poverty programs.
Well, Senator Simon, on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thanks very much for joining us. Senator Paul Simon, the senior senator from Illinois. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be talking about the father of hate radio. And after that, we'll be joined by Professor Francis Fox Piven and Larry Bensky to talk about welfare and the bill that just cleared the Senate, 74-24, to end it as we know it. Stay with us.
Fellow citizen, when men are busy protecting the gospel of slavery, the gospel tis true that brought Rome to the pinnacle of greatness only to hurl her into the black gorge of death, I ask you to picture this same Christ seated upon some peak of the Rockies or the Appalachians, scanning the fields and the cities of our nation. I wonder if he is shedding tears for the desolation and havoc which has ridden roughshod over the plains of our Middle West. I wonder if his heart is sad as he beholds the millions resident in our great cities, millions whom he has fed and clothed through the miracles of inventions, millions who, having turned their backs upon him, have walked with him no more, but like sheep are being led to slaughter by Judas goats of high finance, of industry and labor, who are solicitors only for the 30 pieces of silver which they will obtain by selling Christ's brothers for carnage and crucifixion on some foreign battlefield.
The voice of Father Charles Coughlin, the infamous Roman Catholic priest from Michigan who roused radio listeners during the Great Depression with fire and brimstone speeches that fueled racial and ethnic prejudice. Donald Warren, a professor of sociology and anthropology at Oakland University in Michigan, has spent 20 years researching Coughlin's rise and his connections to fascist and Nazi movements. His new book is called Radio Priest, Charles Coughlin, the father of hate radio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, tell us a little about who this Charles Coughlin was. I'm sure many of our listeners actually remember listening to him, though I don't.
Well, it's a cautionary tale, Amy, of a person who began broadcasting in 1926 and reached out to people across religious lines and later became one of the figures that we identify with dividing people and promoting hatred. He was the first media figure to blend religion, entertainment, and politics. And so in that sense, he was at the dawn of the media era, and he was the first, and in a sense, he abused his power. This often happens to people who attain fame and importance, and so his life is a tragic tale of someone who, instead of promoting the society, solving its problems, made things, I think, much worse.
Now, he began his radio career, Father Charles Coughlin, in the late 1920s.
Yes, that's right. On one Detroit station, he eventually went national. CBS had a contract with him beginning in 1930. His audience was incredible in terms of the size. It's hard for us now to realize that if he had 30 million listeners, that was well over half the population that had radios. And people would, as you walk down the street, have their radios on, and even if your home didn't have a radio, you could hear him speaking, and this was true in New York and Boston neighborhoods. And he was, in that sense, a figure who spoke to more people in this medium of radio than had ever been done before.
Who were his targets?
Well, he was, in a sense, claiming to speak for the people, and we can speak of a demagogue who attacks the elite, the establishment, the bankers. In fact, he coined a term. He talked about the banksters as if they were, of course, gangsters.
Now, a lot of people are going to like this.
Oh, it was a delightful way to try to blame someone for the horrendous problems, and these were genuine. So he dealt with genuine grievances, but what he did was to try to blame targets and not really attack the real causes of problems.
Now, Jews were a particular favorite of his, and yet he referred to them in code in a way that you see politicians talking about African Americans today.
Yes, this is true. Anti-Semitism in those days was not a common approach and was more or less an underground movement. Unfortunately, what Father Coughlin did was to try to legitimate it as part of our political agenda and dialogue. And he failed, ultimately. The reason he failed, in part, was because Americans were associating anti-Semitism at that time increasingly with Nazism. And, of course, he spoke against Jews at a very horrendous time. And for that, he has never been able to cleanse himself, regardless of, in later years, he claimed that he was only interested in pointing out the problems of the elite and so forth. But he was a figure who, in that sense, popularized hatred.
What about his relationship with the Nazis?
Well, I've researched this in some detail, and I've come up with what are, I think, we would call money laundering arrangements of one sort or another that may have existed. He was someone who was interested in being on the world stage. And since Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini were key figures, he reached out to them to try to provide a basis for their using his ideas. And so he even wrote letters. There's an archive of letters he wrote to Benito Mussolini. And he did have intermediary contacts with representatives of the German government. This was, I think, his endeavor to stay at center stage. And he would do almost anything, but of course these associations led to his downfall.
How ultimately did he get kicked off the airwaves?
Well, it's a very complicated story. His own bishop, by that time a person who the church had brought in order to damp down his influence, worked on trying to restrict the content of his programs. And also, he lost touch with the public, but the Roosevelt administration that for years had been his target. He had called Roosevelt a liar, anti-God, horrible names, the kind of thing, though, that we've heard in hate radio today. It was a combination of factors, including the investigations of his links to what became enemies of America, even though he claimed to be a great patriot.
Right, so it wasn't really his anti-Semitism, is it, that the Germans were enemies of the government?
Well, this is true, and I think that one of the important things about Charles Coughlin is that here is someone that would do almost anything to keep his audience, to be popular, and he felt that even to the point of trying to create a militia group, and he mobilized people around his voice and around his leadership, some of whom developed a plot to try to overthrow the U.S. government.
He called these, what, neighborhood platoons?
Yes. It was called the Christian Front. It was a national movement organized locally. And one of those battalions, as you referred to it, decided on their own, not without his direct influence, that they were going to start assassinating Jews and government officials, and they hoped that would foment a revolution in which the communists would, if they were attacked, then they would lead to a reaction, and the country would finally rid itself of what Coughlin saw as the enemies of American democracy. There was an agent planted within the group. They were brought to trial. They were never convicted. It's a fascinating story. Quite reminiscent of some of the things, of course, we've seen recently.
Did he deal directly with them, or they were inspired by his radio rhetoric?
Well, it was always kept a little bit ambiguous, partly because his own bishop had warned him against extremist kinds of political activity. And so he offered his guidance to the group, his counsel, rather than his formal leadership. But I think that was subterfuge, more or less.
We're talking with Professor Donald Warren, who's written a very interesting book called Radio Priest, Charles Coughlin, the father of hate radio. Donald Warren, who comes from the same state who Charles Coughlin does. Rush Limbaugh, Bob Grant, how do you think these hate radio artists, if you will, how do you think they compare to Coughlin?
Well, the rhetoric is similar. The attack on a person using the most vile kind of language, this is something which we've observed with a number of political talk hosts. And so in that sense, the granddaddy, so to speak, the ancestor, is Charles Coughlin. I think also the particular view that the average American is the victim of a conspiracy of the elite. And I think there's a very strong connection. Anyone who now speaks, for example, of the rich or the affluent or the powerful being in charge of our society and attacking the middle class, this is the view that Coughlin promoted, and we see this, of course, echoed across the country today.
I asked who the targets were. Who were the people who he most appealed to?
I think he appealed to what I call middle America. He appealed to those people who were caught in the terrible effects of the Depression, who were looking for answers, who may have felt that the poor and the rich together were conspiring against the middle class. I call these middle American radicals. They are neither conservatives nor liberals. This is a special kind of politics, and we saw this in the George Wallace movement, and actually that inspired me to look back to see if there was an antecedent to that important movement in the 70s.
In fact, you wrote a book called The Radical Center, Middle Americans and the Politics
right.
of Alienation.
Yes. So I see this theme echoing today, and I think this is an important part of understanding the political spectrum. It is something which I think is dangerous, but at the same time is built on some concerns that people feel may not be addressed by the political parties that exist.
At the time, how aware was the president, President Roosevelt, of Father Charles Coughlin?
Well, I heard stories that he used to imitate Coughlin's voice in private dinner parties. Very aware, but Roosevelt was a very shrewd political figure. he felt that if he gave any direct recognition to Coughlin of his influence, and Coughlin had many members of Congress here in Washington, he visited here frequently, he had contacts around both the Republican and Democratic parties. So Roosevelt felt the best thing was to try to act as if Coughlin was not a power. But in fact, on several occasions, Coughlin had enough influence across the country to defeat or delay major elements of Roosevelt's domestic and foreign policy. Beginning, for example, with the World Court in 1935, this was the first effort by the United States since the involvement in World War I. We, of course, did not join the League of Nations to participate in some effort on a world basis to try to control aggression. And there was a vote in Congress. It certainly wasn't Coughlin's influence alone. Nevertheless, he mobilized millions of his radio listeners to write and send telegrams into Washington. And the World Court support by the U.S. was defeated, so we never participated in that effort. And it was for Roosevelt a somewhat shocking defeat, and he recognized he had an adversary of some influence here who continued that way for several years.
Professor Warren, what was the influence of corporations and how much did they support Father Coughlin? You see today AstroTurf lobbying in Washington, yes. Which is, you have this, it's quite something. You have on some of these hate radio programs, you'll have the host talking about an issue, say around guns, everyone should have an assault weapon. And then it goes to commercial, where it says, if you want to call this 800 number, they'll give you more information. And then the 800 number, whether it's the NRA or whatever, they link you directly to Washington, to your Congress member's office after you've been briefed on what to say. You're not paying for the call, and you call your Congress member.
Yes. Coughlin would have loved that. He had individual financial backers. Anyone who entered politics, of course, as he did, part of the book deals with his forming a third party in 1936. He had individual backers, including the owner of the radio station in Detroit at that time, WJR, and he had a number of Wall Streeters. It's so ironic because he claimed to be protecting the average person against the machinations of Wall Street, and yet he had speculated in silver. He had several individuals whose basic occupation was precisely to speculate, and here he was drawing on them when he entered politics. So he had several individual sort of members of his network that supported him financially.
Well, you have Pat Buchanan with the same targets. He, too, has a $1 million stock portfolio that invests in many of the companies that he is at least alluding to in his populist rhetoric.
Yes, well, I think that Charles Coughlin, as I said, is a sort of object lesson to all of us of the dangers of a person who has the power of the microphone and who abuses it.
What about his attempts to form a third party in 1936? We're talking about, at the time, the world scene. You've got the rise of Adolf Hitler. In fact, 1936 was the Nazi Olympics. We just did a special on that yesterday on Democracy Now!
Yes. Well, his third party, I would say, was organized around the discontented, those who felt that the New Deal wasn't going far enough, and around Republicans who were unhappy with their party. He was speaking to those people in the country who hadn't really benefited as yet by the New Deal and who were, in a sense, doing better than they had been and were now looking at whether minorities, for example, were taking advantage of the new social welfare programs that were being implemented by the New Deal. This sounds a little familiar. That's what strikes me about Coughlin. It's much of what he says, and the issues look like they're in yesterday's newspaper. So his third party, ironically, was not a great success. He had a character flaw, which was exaggeration. He greatly overestimated the fact that if people would listen and send in money day after day and week after week, that they would vote for his candidate. Roosevelt took the election in 36 by a landslide, but there was a scare, and the Democratic Party was frightened by the power that Coughlin could mobilize.
What did the Catholic Church feel about his forming of a third party?
Well, that's a fascinating tale. Again, Coughlin's main impact on the church was to divide it. He had millions of followers at a time when the church was struggling, losing funds itself, and yet he was able to raise millions. He also, when he was challenged to be off the air, threatened to pull his millions of followers out of the church, and that was a very realistic possibility to form a schism. And he had this kind of power. Some persons in the church were his close allies, others bitter enemies. There was no one who was neutral about Charles Coughlin.
I mean, it wasn't as if the Pope was outspoken against Nazi atrocities in World War II.
Well, the way I would put it is that the church was concerned with presenting itself as in favor of human concerns and was not perhaps vigorous enough in pointing out that privately they had reprimanded Charles Coughlin for his anti-Semitism and for many of his ideas, but publicly felt that the church should be unified. And on that basis, Coughlin continued on his way for quite a few years.
Donald Warren, as we wrap up, who would you say is the single person who is most like Charles Coughlin today?
Oh, that's a very dangerous question. I would say there are a number of people, and I would even have to mention Louis Farrakhan as a person who reminds me to some extent of Charles Coughlin. So we have in our society today people who feel they are speaking to help those who are hurting, but may be hurting the society in a far greater way.
Would you say Bob Grant, Pat Buchanan, Rush Limbaugh?
Well, rather than mention individuals, I would say we have a climate in our society today that promotes this kind of hatred.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Donald Warren, who is author of Radio Priest, Charles Coughlin, the Father of Hate Radio. Up next, we take a look at welfare and what happened in the Senate yesterday. We'll be speaking with Francis Fox Piven, and we'll be taking a look at President Clinton in California with Larry Bensky. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. President Clinton has been out in California as the Senate has been working on the issue of welfare. We're joined right now by our Pacifica National Affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky. We're also joined on the telephone by Francis Fox Piven, who has long written books and been a professor who has focused on the issue of welfare. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Glad to talk to you.
And Larry, why don't we begin with you and what President Clinton has been doing, and then we can talk about what has happened in the Senate in this landmark legislation, I think you could say.
What President Clinton has been doing, Amy, is raising money, to put not too fine a term on it. This was a fundraising tour. It's obviously a campaign tour as well. He was here in California for just a little over 36 hours, and that, combined with his Colorado stay, apparently raised him slightly over $5 million, although the final accounting isn't in. He spoke here in San Francisco last night to an audience of some 400 people, each of whom paid $1,000 to get in to see him. Then he also spoke at several private parties where several hundred thousand dollars more was raised.
$5 million. Actually, it doesn't compare to that one dinner he had about a month ago where he raised $12 million.
Well, the whole thing is obscene and out of control. And, you know, it's interesting to notice that the procedure of doing this now is seen to be so normal as to not even be worthy of comment. People who go to these things, go expecting to have some access to the president now and in the future. The media cover it as if it's just another way of him giving a speech, and the figures of how much money he raises are kind of an afterthought.
Larry, do you have any of the comments of President Clinton on his swing from Colorado through California?
Well, one thing he spoke about last night, Amy, and what we're going to talk to Ms. Piven about right now is his attitude towards welfare. And here he's doing something which I think is very skillful. He's blending together issues which he believes will be of interest to the segment of the electorate that he especially tries to appeal to, which is to say the middle class, the people who vote more than others, and at the same time trying to present his program of one and fairness. Here's a little of what he told the audience here at the San Francisco Hilton last night about welfare.
I've heard a lot of talk about welfare. There's a lot of talk in Washington today about welfare reform. I'll say a little more about that in a minute. But under a law passed in 1988 that as governor I had a privilege to help write, the president can give states permission to move people from welfare to work as long as they take care of the children in the process. 40 of the 50 states have gotten permission to experiment in moving people from welfare to work. 75% of the people in this country are already under welfare reform experiments. And today, without hurting the children of America, there are 1.3 million fewer people on welfare than there were the day I took the oath of office. It is the right sort of welfare reform. And I might add, child support collections are up 40% to $11 billion a year. Now, do we need national legislation? You bet we do. The reason we do is we still don't have the power we need to really collect all the child support that is legally owed and could be paid across state lines. And if everybody paid what they owe and could pay, we could reduce the welfare rolls by another 800,000 women and children tomorrow morning.
President Clinton mixing together the issue which has appeal, especially to women, of reform of the child support laws, but basically interweaving it with his supposed welfare reform measures. And I'd like to ask Frances Fox Piven, first of all, what she thinks of his statistics, 1.3 million fewer people on welfare and a 40% increase in child support collection. Does this accord with what you think is going on?
Well, the welfare rolls have been going down. They've been going down largely as a result of the state waiver plan, which the Clinton administration has approved. No one knows what is happening to the people who have been cut off welfare or intimidated from applying for welfare because of the harshness of these state plans. And again, I underline, which the Clinton administration has approved. I was very interested by the excerpt that you played of Clinton's speech, because on the one hand, he took credit for reforming, deforming welfare as a result of the state waivers. And he has approved the overwhelming majority of those waivers. They began certainly before him, but most of them have rushed forward under Clinton, and he in turn has rushed to approve them. They almost invariably consist of time limits, benefit cuts, sanctions for families if kids are truant from school, other behavioral controls. They are quite harsh. And in a sense, Clinton is right. You don't need legislation in the Congress if the federal government uses a provision in the Social Security Act, which was originally inserted in order to allow demonstrations or experiments, presumably in the interest of the well-being of welfare recipients.
Well, what about this well-being of the welfare recipients question? If there are 1.3 fewer people on welfare, isn't that just about the same number of people that is now estimated are newly poor, especially children, since Clinton took office? Don't we have just as many poor developing in a society as we have people being cut off welfare?
Yeah, that seems like a rough match. The other figure that's thrown around, which has to do with the number of poor children that will be created by the congressional legislation, and that's which is over a million. But that's very misleading because it doesn't include the numbers of children who are already poor but will be made much poorer as a result of the legislation. I don't know why everybody's fastened on that figure.
Professor Piven, you were founder of the welfare rights movement of the 1960s. Do you see anything like the mobilization at that time happening now with the bill, again, just passed yesterday, passed by 74 to 24? So there were a number of Democrats who actually supported this welfare bill that is going to end the federal commitment to provide assistance to any eligible poor American.
Well, there were actually as many Democrats who voted for it as voted against it. It's a real calamity, and it speaks very badly for what's become of the Democratic Party. Will there be protests as there were in the 1960s? Almost inevitably. The question is when and under what conditions. Sooner or later, there will be. There will be children begging in the street. The visible, palpable evidence of these cutbacks will soon reach other groups. They will see it. Moreover, this is not just an AFDC cut. This is not just a reform of AFDC, although that's what everybody talks about. This bill also cuts other social services, and the Medicaid bill, which is coming up, will include cuts, if you count state cutbacks and federal cutbacks, in the order of $250 billion over the next 6 years. So what we are confronting now is a massive effort to dismantle that part of the American welfare state which reached poorer people, to take back the money. It's, you know, an expression of unbridled greed. And that will also affect lots of working people, lots of jobs, social service jobs, health jobs, the landlords who rent the apartments to the people who work in those social service and health jobs, the bodegas and grocery stores who sell to them and who also, of course, sell to welfare recipients, who now will have, there'll be fewer of them, and they will have less money. I think as the reverberation of this development become evident, social protest is much more likely, because now the situation is, first, that welfare recipients don't have a clear picture of what is happening. Indeed, most of us don't have a clear picture of what is happening. The moves come so fast and furious, it's very hard to keep track of just what is being proposed and what is being voted on.
Well, it's easy for welfare recipients out here in California to keep track of what's happening, Ms. Piven, because
there are no other loud, strong voices coming to their defense. Where's organized labor? Where's the civil rights community? Everybody is quiet, including, of course, the advocates. They speak with a very small, timid voice now, too. So the combination of being unsure about just what's happening and feeling so isolated, I think, helps account for why there's been so much quiet among the people, such quiet among the people who are going to be the victim of what is a truly draconian move in social policy, totally reckless move.
There was a demonstration outside of President Clinton's appearance here in San Francisco last night where several hundred people, most of them Asian Americans, who were protesting against the aid cut to legal immigrants, were present. And there were also demonstrators trying to get more of the Headwaters Forest preserved and several other causes as well. But what I wanted to take up on there for a moment, Ms. Piven, you said that people don't yet know what's happening. They certainly know what's happening to them. For example, here in California, the legislature, blessed by the governor and now the president, has just cut back the AFDC grant. A single parent with two children, instead of getting $602 a month, will now get something like $561 a month. That's $561 a month for a parent and two children to pay their rent, to get their food, unless they have supplemented food stamps, to try to buy clothes, etc. So People are seeing the effects of this already on the ground, aren't they?
Yeah, they're beginning to see the effects of it. In some states, like California, the moves have been harsher than in other moves. By the way, California is still something like $175 higher in its grant levels than the national average. So, that's how bad it is. The grant that the Congress is intent on eliminating are very, very low. The cash grants are about half of what they were in the early 1970s in real terms.
Professor Piven, I think it would be instructive to just go through the highlights of the welfare changes. Among the major provisions are that the federal guarantee of cash assistance for poor children would end. Each state would get a lump sum of money to run its own welfare and work programs. The head of every family on welfare would be required to work within 2 years or the family would lose benefits. Lifetime welfare benefits would be limited to 5 years. States may set stricter time limits. 20% of families, though, may be exempted because of hardship. States could stop payments to unmarried teenage parents. Payments may be made only if a mother under the age of 18 stays in school and lives with an adult. States that reduce birth to unmarried women would be rewarded with additional cash grants. And finally, about 300,000 disabled children from low-income families would lose cash benefits because of stricter eligibility standards in the Supplemental Security Income Program, that's SSI. So 250,000 kids from low-income families would lose cash benefits, kids who are disabled.
Right. And then there are the provisions cutting off legal immigrants.
Go ahead.
So another big cut is that legal immigrants will not accepting for asylees will not be allowed to be supported by any of these programs.
Now, President Clinton has clearly been going back and forth on welfare, supporting a measure that encouraged Senate Democrats to support that ultimately then he turned against because of pressure. I remember in New York he was going to be speaking at a major fundraising event, and then the White House heard that there were going to be thousands of people outside protesting his stance on welfare. And I know that his close friend, Marion Wright Edelman, the head of the Children's Defense Fund, has been putting pressure. And yet it looks like ultimately he would support this. I mean, he did not exactly condemn it yesterday.
No, but although he's looking for a way, as he has from the beginning, because he bears a very large responsibility for setting this roller coaster running with his 92 campaign slogans. He's looking for a way to sign a harsh welfare bill. Just as he approved the harsh state waiver plan, 37 of them, and at the same time claim that he is not hurting children. And that's why he has emphasized, for example, that he would like vouchers to be available for children when families are cut off after they've exhausted the time limits, vouchers for diapers and food and so forth. Completely cockeyed scheme. I mean, how they're going to administer such a scheme without giving aid to mothers as well? Of course, nobody knows. I mean, that's an impossible scheme.
Well, they've defeated that proposal anyway.
They defeated it anyway.
We're in a position now of perceived economic flush times. What happens, Francis Fox Piven, when the economy turns down and there's no more guarantee of cash benefits to poor people for welfare? It's all up to the states, and the states have to decide if they want to have better-paid prison guards or better-paved roads or their poor people eating. What happens then?
What happens then is that the President and Congress of the United States begins to deliberate creating a federal responsibility for welfare. That's what happens, particularly if that downturn provokes protests, as it very likely will, but it will certainly provoke mayors and governors to clamor for aid from the federal government. So we'll begin again, probably in much with legislation of the kind that we have now, which isn't so good, by the way. We should not forget in all of our in our despair at what the Congress is doing and what the president is encouraging, we should not despair that this welfare program and the associated programs like Medicaid are deeply flawed. They're not great programs. One of the ways that they're flawed is that they do keep people so miserably poor. Other Western countries give cash assistance to single-parent households, but they don't humiliate them by keeping them so miserably poor.
Professor Piven, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We do have to go. And Larry, thanks very much for being with us from Berkeley, where President Clinton has been in the last 2 days. Professor Francis Pax Piven, founder of the welfare rights movement in the 60s, member of the Campaign for Media Fairness on Welfare, and author of many books on the subject. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Kenneth Mason has been our engineer. Bill Wax, our director. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be taking up a number of these issues. You can write to us at our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
This is Lou Hankins, Acting General Manager here at WBFW.